Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Think about all of the information that's stored in your brain.
My name is
Kevin Berth.
Netta Freja.
And I can remember millions of details about you, your life, your job, facts you've learned, landscapes you've seen, meals you've enjoyed.
Something called achar, which is like Indian pickle.
We would walk outside.
I can remember coconut crab hunting late at night.
The Latin name is Schmittea Mediterranea.
Sleep is a homeostatic process.
1972.
I believe I was in a car with my dad.
My parents separated.
The food goes into our esophagus.
I particularly remember
this morning I had oats and an egg.
What do we remember? What do we forget? Today's episode is about memory, how we store all of this information, and where it lives.
Well, I define memory as any change that happens to the brain with experience.
That's Michael Yassa. He is a professor of neurobiology at the University of California, Irvine. So his broadest definition of memory is this: anything that you do and experience, from eating oatmeal in the morning to learning a new language or getting married, the brain has a record of it, and that constitutes memory. Is our memory capacity limited, though? Sometimes I think of my brain as this hard drive, and I have to delete something if I want to store something new.
Yeah, so there is this interesting analogy that has been used in the past when people talk about memory. They talk about it as a library with a finite amount of space on its shelves. And if you need to, you know, pack more books into that library or on that shelf, you need to clear out some of the old ones to make space for the new ones. Turns out that there's not really a good basis for that. Actually, our capacity is not as limited as we might think it is. We have tremendous machinery in the brain to keep storing many, many more memories than we will ever experience in a lifetime.
But Michael says sometimes we get distracted or we're tired, not focused, and we don't retain details. But it's not because of limited space. What do we know about where memory lives in the brain and how that process even functions?
Yeah. So this is a search that has gone on for probably about 7 or 8 decades easily for people to look at where in the brain are memories stored. And some of the initial experiments were very simple. They went in animals and lesioned or took out surgically different parts of the brain and asked, what is the impact that that might have on memory? Now, the answer was quite surprising. It turned out that everywhere that they lesioned had an effect on memory. So the conclusion from those early experiments is that memory is impossible. It just didn't make any sense.
The more researchers looked into this, the more they found that memory is distributed throughout the brain. Different regions serve different functions.
So the hippocampus is one you might have heard about in the past. But memories don't actually live in the hippocampus. The hippocampus is just a gateway that allows us to store those memories. And if we lose the hippocampus, we lose the ability to store those memories. But in the long run, those memories end up getting stored throughout the brain. They're very much distributed representations in the brain.
And stored as what?
Yeah, that's another great question. And it's probably, when I say it, it almost sounds mysterious. Like, what is the storage mechanism? And to our best guess today, we believe that memories are stored in the connections between brain cells, or what we call synapses. And when you have an experience that activates a certain number of those brain cells, the wiring between them gets strengthened. So the ability by which they're able to communicate with one another through those synapses is strengthened. And that strengthened representation is where we think that memory, quote unquote, lives.
Michael says from an evolutionary perspective, our memory helps keep our species alive.
So you can imagine if we made a decision that was detrimental to our survival, like And from an evolutionary standpoint, you can say eating that poisonous berry. If we did that once and got sick from it and we remembered, we probably would not do it again. But if we had no memory, we would keep doing it over and over, obviously much to our detriment.
And we need our memory for learning from the time we're born. It allows us to figure things out. Like when I toss this toy on the floor, the big person over there picks it up. When I experience discomfort, I have to yell and scream until somebody helps me. The basics. But while we rely heavily on our memory during those early years, we don't seem to remember that time in our lives at all. Why is that? Do those early memories even matter? Jad Slaman looked into that.
The story you're about to hear, I've heard easily 1,000 times. It's my mom's favorite story about me when I was little. It involves these tiny toy cars.
Micro Machine. The mini machine, Micro Machine.
I called her up. It's Micro Machine. She says my uncle Ahmed would bring me loads of these things. Got them from work.
He worked at Ford Company.
This is in Detroit?
Yeah, in Detroit. You were maybe 1.5 to 3 years old. And you used to love them.
I lived a simpler life then.
All the time, you play with them. You sit on the couch, eating chips, and counting the cars on the highway, watching cars going and coming.
According to my mom, I would have one of these tiny cars in my hand at all times.
You used to sleep with Abbas, he's our friend.
Abbas would stay with us on visits to Detroit. He'd have to crash with me.
We had only a small apartment, so he will sleep in your room.
Invariably, I'd wear myself out watching highway traffic, eating chips, and fall asleep with one of these toy cars in my hand. And every time I woke up, it would be gone. And 3-year-old me demanded that Abbas had to get up and help me look, even in the middle of the night.
You wake him up at night. You want that car that last was in your hand. He doesn't know which one. You throw it in his face, and you keep telling him, this is not it, this is not it.
I apparently expected Abbas to know which one I wanted without giving him any clues. No make, no model.
Yeah, he will look in tons of cars and he keeps giving you one after the other until you find the one you want, which we don't know which one, but you know it.
In this story, I had toys I liked, things I liked doing. I even had something like a personality, kind of a bratty one. But the thing is, I don't remember any of this. My earliest memories don't start until after kindergarten. When my mom tells me these older stories, it's weird, almost like she's talking about a stranger. This is because of childhood amnesia. It's something we all go through. Emory University memory researcher Patricia Bauer has studied this type of forgetting for years, and she tells me it baffled psychologists basically forever.
You know, they called it for many, many, many years the mystery of childhood amnesia.
And so it went until researchers finally had the bright idea of asking kids what they remembered.
It's so obvious, isn't it? It's so obvious, but yet we didn't do it for years and years and years.
For a long time, serious scientists didn't think toddlers under 3 even formed memories, at least not in the same way older kids and adults do.
But as soon as we started examining it in childhood and we started to see that, yes, children form memories, yes, children retain them, and yes, they forget them, just like adults, just a little bit faster.
Well, actually, a lot faster. Patricia and her team found 3-year-olds could recall something that happened to them when they were, say, 18 months old. And they found if they asked them again at ages between 5 and 7, most of the earliest stuff was still there. But then, after that, there's this steep drop. By age 9, most of it is gone.
Certainly, they didn't forget everything from their past. You know, they're not just like a completely wiped clean slate. You still have, of course, your memories of your family. You know where you live. You know a lot of information.
You still know, okay, I'm the younger child. This is how you tie a shoe. Dinosaurs are cool. But a lot of autobiographical memories, your life story, seems to evaporate.
It's not that children can't learn and they can't remember, it's that they forget more rapidly. And so those early memories that you encoded end up getting lost over time.
Bridget Callaghan is a researcher at UCLA focused on early memories. She works a lot with kids and tells me about one study where children watch 2 adults interact with toys. The adults pretend one toy sucks and the other is awesome.
There were toys we made ourselves. So there was one that was like a fish toy and it made a really fun boing noise. And there was one that was a monkey and it made a slightly different kind of noise.
She'll see how the kids interact with the toys weeks later. Usually, they remember the cool adults liked the fish toy, how they avoided the lame monkey toy. Eventually, though, quicker than an adult would, they'll forget the scene and choose at random. But Bridget thinks while we forget experiences, they're not really gone.
I think that our memories, and I'm speaking of memories, whether we remember them or not, but these experiences that we have in our life that shape us and have an impact on us, really do contribute a lot to our personalities, so the way that we function as adults.
Bridget thinks early events can still encode themselves in us in unseen ways, leave footprints. You see it in children who were abused or neglected when they were very young. They may not remember any of that, but it can still make a distinct impact on brain structures, even affect gut bacteria. And there's the effect these events have on our internal logic.
They kind of shape our working models of the world, the way that we understand the way the world works and our place in it.
Early events, like Abess always fetching me those cars in the middle of the night, they can have profound effects on us.
It sounds like whenever you wanted the toy car, he was there to give it to you, and that probably helped you set up this really reliable view of adults being helpful and someone that you could rely on.
Or, I don't know, maybe Abess is at least partially to blame for some toy store tantrum I threw years later. But okay, so if all this early stuff is affecting who I am now, shaping me, how can it just be completely gone? Why can't I remember any of it? Bridget thinks part of it has to do with language.
When you encode a memory, it's kind of stuck in time, at least in terms of the language that you can use to describe it.
Basically, a toddler's vocabulary is all I had to work with.
And as you kind of develop, you grow, and your language becomes more complex, your concepts become more complex, it actually becomes difficult for you to kind of retrieve those older memories that are stuck in time and difficult to update.
And the other reason is, when you're really little, your sense of self is still developing.
So it's not till about 20 months of age that babies start to show what's called mirror self-recognition.
Another Emory researcher, Robin Fivish, is telling me about autobiographical memories, how we get started making these little bits of life story.
They recognize themselves in the mirror. Oh, that's what I look like. That's me. Which shows an awareness that they start to understand what they look like from somebody else's perspective.
That's step one.
Because an autobiographical memory system is about me, not just about what happened, but what happened to me.
Basically, you need to recognize I'm an individual person, separate from mom and the lamp, before you can start a life story. And Robin thinks step two has to do with stories, the ones we tell about ourselves. It's why researchers think kids begin to really form autobiographical memories only in the preschool years.
So what they learn over the course of the preschool years is through language to tell a fuller, more coherent story. That reorganizes the memory to make it more complete and more organized, and that makes it more durable.
Robin thinks the stories we tell are key to making memories stick, making them meaningful.
We search for meaning in the world, and stories are the way that we create meaning for ourselves, for other people. We understand everything through stories.
A lot of Robin's work suggests that when parents reminisce often, retelling stories over and over again, their kids will end up with earlier, fuller memories.
This is one thing we absolutely know about memory. The more you reinforce the memory, the better you remember it. The more you rehearse it, the better you remember it.
But if that's the case, I mean, how does that explain the complete blanks I have before, say, age 6 or 7? My mom, she's telling these little Jad stories all the time.
You thought like you are watching TV. You didn't know it was a game.
That's one about how it took me a super long time to understand the difference between cartoons and video games.
After 3 years, you realize it's a game and you can play.
I think it could be language at play again, but in a slightly different way than Bridget is talking about. My mom first told that video game story in Arabic before I reminded her our listeners don't speak that.
No, mom, I live in English. You have to.
For me, not only are my earliest memories stored in toddler language, they're also in Arabic. That's what me and my mom spoke. Even today, we usually mix Arabic and English on the phone. I asked Bridget what she thinks. Did all this scramble things more?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think it's a really good hypothesis. I think it'd be good to test.
I ask for a mention in the footnotes when she publishes her second language memory study. Neuroscientist Paul Franklin, though, tells me language only explains part of the forgetting. As proof, he points to the guinea pig.
At birth, they're much more mature. They can walk, their eyes open soon after birth. They can support their body weight and walk within a couple of days and so on.
They also can make and retain memories even as infants. Part of their brain, the hippocampus, is nearly fully developed in utero. In humans, the hippocampus keeps maturing as infants and kids age. It's also where many of our autobiographical memories are stored. So the forgetting, it's actually part of a developmental give and take.
You know, the cost of adding new neurons is that you're going to destabilize stuff you've already stored in the brain. But the, you know, the benefit down the line is that you know, these new neurons are good for making new memories as well.
So the cost of remembering my 20s and 30s might be not remembering my 2s and 3s.
Mama, you were like 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. All this you don't remember.
I guess my mom can go ahead and remember for me.
And the mini Legos, you divide them and you play with them. You remember which one is yours. And
for the Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
If you have a friend or a loved one who has Alzheimer's or dementia, you've probably seen this happen. The person doesn't seem to remember much of anything. Not your name, not your face, not where they are. But then something seems to spark a flicker of recognition or recall. We got this story from a friend of mine, Katie.
My grandmother, who had Alzheimer's disease, we had gone to visit her in the nursing home. And she got to a point where, after being a wonderful, incredible storyteller for many, many years, she'd sort of lost that ability. But she remembered music. And any time that you would play music for her, that would just kind of like almost like reawaken her. And she just kept singing this one Barry Manilow song, "Looks Like We Made It." So whenever we would go visit her, we would all start singing that song, and all of the lyrics would just come back to her. And it was this, you know, interesting way that we were able to communicate with her again in a way that she could no longer do with us by just speaking.
So if memories are still in there, could you coax them out more frequently? Before the pandemic hit in the U.S., reporter Lesha Bushek visited an adult daycare center in Baltimore that's trying to do just that.
A really fun storefront to decorate.
It feels like I've stepped onto a movie set, or maybe I'm in a time warp. I'm at Town Square, an adult daycare facility in Baltimore, and it looks like an indoor replica of an American town in the 1950s. There's Rosie's Diner and a movie theater with pictures of Elvis Presley on the wall, storefronts with vintage auto repair posters, and furniture that looks like it could be from an antique store or from my grandma's basement. And perhaps the biggest attention grabber, a shiny blue Chevy with white rim tires, a boxy frame, and a sleek white roof.
When people walk through that door and see that car, the 55 Bel Air, it's like automatic. They click. You just see it in their eyes. You see it in their face. They're just awakened.
Megan Reinman is the activities manager at Town Square.
They'll start talking about, oh, I had one just like this, or my dad had one just like this. We took so many trips in this. And even the smell. Inside the car triggers people.
This is all part of something known as reminiscence therapy. Town Square serves people with dementia and Alzheimer's. They come here to spend the day, and being here seems to spark memories for them. Sometimes those memories come back through visual cues, like old Life magazines posted up on a newsstand featuring covers with John F. Kennedy, or through sounds, like this jukebox in the diner that plays swing tunes. Or sometimes it's through programs where staff members try to jog memories through pictures, books, or conversations. In one room, reading a book about animals sparks some memories for one member.
My husband would come to bed and he'd go to sleep and the dog would crawl right over my husband to get in between the two of us. He said, "What ran over me?" I said, "The dog."
you for sharing, Miss Lil. Thank you so much for sharing.
But how exactly does reminiscence therapy work? Alzheimer's disease damages parts of the brain, which leads to memory loss. But more and more, researchers are beginning to believe that memories aren't fully lost or destroyed. Rather, some are just hidden and need to be coaxed out. Some of this relates to the difference between short-term and long-term memory. Arjun Masarkar is a neurologist at New York University. He says short-term memories tend to be stored in the hippocampus, while longer-term memories are tucked away in a variety of different brain regions.
So the hippocampus being essential for remembering what we did yesterday and a week ago, it's just very vulnerable to destruction by Alzheimer's disease, but also by brain trauma and stroke. Whereas for some reason, the brain structures that are associated with long-term memories are implicitly, intrinsically very strong, very robust. Maybe there's a lot of sharing of the network in terms of how that information is stored.
This is also why we shouldn't assume that memory loss means all memories are gone forever, says Stephen Sabat, a neuropsychologist at Georgetown University.
The networks that are involved with important events are tremendous. It's less likely that you could poke a hole in one part of the brain and destroy the entire memory itself.
Stephen says there's memory, and then there are roads in the brain to access those memories.
So it's really difficult to destroy memory per se, much easier to destroy a person's ability to gain access to it.
And it seems like Alzheimer's affects the roads more than the memory itself.
But there are other structures in the brain that are involved in memory too. And that's why implicit functions are still possible, even though there's hippocampus damage.
Arjun says there is some evidence that when the typical routes to access memories may be impaired, those memories can still be triggered by new or different routes.
There's probably a secondary mechanism, a road, so to speak, that allows that long-term memory to then be brought into our attention, into our focus. And it's probably damage of those roads or that process that kind of is an interruption or a short circuit. And so you're not able to jog that memory out in your typical means. And then with a therapy, like reminiscence therapy, you may be kind of finding alternative pathways to jog out that memory.
Through visuals like that shiny blue Chevy at Town Square or smells and music. Here's Stephen again.
You hear a song and you remember what was happening in your life when you heard that song, and you get the feeling. You can recall the feeling of that time.
For me, it's like Living on a Prayer by Bon Jovi.
Christy Turner is a dementia care specialist in Portland, Oregon.
Boom, I'm 17 again, and all of the sights and sounds is, and experiences of being 17. And so that's why music is so important.
She says that reminiscence therapy is about drawing out that positive feeling, a feeling that stays with you even when the specific memory can't be recalled.
A sense of self, a sense of feeling anchored into who they are right now, not feeling sort of untethered.
And studies have shown that reminiscence therapy can help reduce anxiety and agitation.
Are these like actual copies from the 1950s?
Actual copies.
Yeah, back at Town Square, Megan, the activities director, says that's what they're trying to hone in on.
We have a gentleman that comes in and plays the piano, plays older songs. After he left, one of our members just got to the piano and started playing. She hasn't played in a very, very long time. And when she was done, we were like, hey, we didn't know you played piano. And she was like, I don't know how to play piano. But she was there in that moment, and her body just knew what to do. That's what we're hoping for, to bring them back to what they used to be, just even if it's for a couple seconds.
That was Lesha Bushak reporting. She did that story earlier on this year. The center is currently closed due to coronavirus restrictions in the state of Maryland. We're talking about memory, and there definitely seems to be a connection between memory and music. Here's something that happens to me all of the time. I'm walking around, going about my day, and then a song pops into my head, and I start singing it. Here's one that's always on rotation. Sorry, I'm not much of a singer.
Your home's where you're happy.
There are two things that fascinate me about this. One, how do we store so much music in our brains? And two, what hits play, if you will, on this internal jukebox? Like, what makes those songs play all of a sudden?
Your home is where you're happy.
Your home's where you're happy. It's not where you're not free. Your home is where you...
This song I'm always singing is a Lemonhead song. I have a mixtape from 1990 in my basement that has that song on it. When a friend gave me this tape, I was failing miserably in school and spending most of my time at a divey cafe in Germany. But why this song? Why does it pop into my head all of the time? I decided to start at the source, so to speak. I called up John Strom. He was the drummer for the Lemonheads, and now he's an attorney in Nashville.
This is John.
I asked John if he could still sing that song.
Your home is where you're happy. It's not where you're not free. Your home is where you can be what you want. Because you were just born to be free, or something like that. Do you know it was written by Charles Manson?
I found that out. I was... It didn't really make me happy.
Yeah. Well, he's quite a good songwriter, you know. Evan Danda from the Lemonheads was obsessed with Charles Manson at that time.
John and I talked about music and memory, and he told me that he often ends up singing a Billy Joel song that gets stuck in his head. Which one?
Oh, no. If I say the title, it'll get stuck in my head. What's the one? Anthony works in the grocery store. That one.
Saving his pennies for someday.
Remember this part?
I respect him as a writer and a musician. I don't dislike his songs. I just don't want them in my head.
But we don't really get to pick what is stored in that vast library. And it is huge. I talked to music psychologist Vicky Williamson from the University of Sheffield in the UK, and she says musicians and music enthusiasts have hundreds of thousands of tunes in their memory.
Well, your brain's very good at remembering a lot of things, of course, but music tends to stick up there along with smell as two types of stimuli that are very provocative, that can stimulate long-term memories very easily and very quickly for people.
She says it's because of the way the brain is structured.
The parts of the brain that are interested in a lot of the emotion in music are very, very close. They're very hotly wired to areas of the brain that are generally interested in memory functions.
This is an oversimplification, but broadly speaking, we're talking about connections between the hippocampus for memory and the superior temporal gyrus for music and the amygdala, which is important in memory and emotions. The brain also gets a bit of an assist because many pieces of music have a lot in common, like their basic structure.
It's not like every piece of music is a brand new experience that you have no guide to.
This is Rick Ashley, not Rick Astley. It's Rick Ashley, who researches music and cognition at Northwestern University.
Your knowledge of the music with which you're familiar, sort of like your native language in music, gives you this huge stock of patterns that let you absorb and recall, sort of reconstitute pieces from memory.
So this explains why we can have such a huge library of melodies stored in our brains. But why do random songs come up at different times? Vicky Williamson says the reason this happens is because our brain is processing all input by constantly scanning all of our existing memory files for information.
Like a spider's web out to all concepts and ideas that are connected somehow.
This is an automatic process. It's not something we have any control over. And it is this process that allows us to learn, to make sense of the world around us. And sometimes the same function hits play on a terrible song.
What's happening when you think, why on earth has that song come into my head? It's probably one of those little spider web tendrils has been activated, but subconsciously. So you're not aware of what you've seen or heard or has been triggered in your mind from the environment because you weren't particularly focusing in on it at the time.
And if you do a bit of detective work, you'll probably figure out a connection to something that happened during your day, says Rick Ashley.
There was something in the lyrics to that song that were triggered by this earlier event.
And with music that has no lyrics, it tends to come to mind because it is reminiscent of a specific mood.
That's a good soundtrack to the plot and the scene that's playing itself out.
So with my song, that Lemonheads tune that I sing all the time, I figured out it tends to pop into my head when I'm on my way home. Simple as that.
Your home is where you can be what you are, 'cause you were just born to be. Now they'll show you their castles and diamonds.
If you're trying to write your own music, create songs, this vast internal music library can be a problem. John Strom, the drummer turned lawyer, told me he wrote a great song, and then he realized it was actually his client's tune.
And I'm a copyright lawyer. This is what I do. I'm the guy that's sending the letter when somebody puts a song out there. You know, it'd be very embarrassing for me to put music out that was infringing.
So sometimes your memory sabotages you when you're trying to do your own thing, but you still need memory to be creative. I talked about this with Kevin Mador. He's a research psychologist at Stanford University. Kevin, what is the relationship between memory and creativity? It seems like we need one for the other.
Yes, so that's definitely how I would describe it. So the idea is that when we remember events, we aren't just pulling out literal photographs from our memory, but we're actively and flexibly reconstructing different details of an experience. So if I asked you what you did last Saturday night, you're not pulling out a photo of that event from your brain. You're thinking about and pulling together bits and pieces of action, people, and setting details, and you're actively putting that together to come up with a memory.
It sounds like I am, in a way, creatively altering my own memories all the time. So I'm inserting my creativity into my memories on a daily basis, in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely how I would describe it.
So if I'm telling you what I did on Saturday night, I might make it sound a bit more fun than what it really was. Maybe I'll skip over certain parts, play up others. I'm using my creativity to make a memory. Kevin says that that process goes both ways.
If you're presented with a creative problem that reminds you of an experience that you've had in the past, you're certainly going to draw on details that that remind you of that. So if you're asked to come up with a creative solution at work and it's similar or on the surface appears similar to a problem you solved at work last week, you're likely to adopt a similar strategy. The idea with creativity is that we're actively reconstructing and coming up with bits and pieces from our prior experiences when we're presented with a creative problem, almost as if our memories are the ingredients that we use to solve creative problems.
So if I can put this in like completely lay terms here, it almost seems like I'm rummaging around in my cupboard of experiences and I'm really taking a close look at everything that's in there. And then later that somehow helps me create a really nice recipe for something else.
Absolutely. Yes. So it seems odd, but that's definitely what we think is happening.
And what might seem like a brand new idea probably isn't.
Nothing, or at least the camp that I'm in, would say that nothing that you're coming up with during the course of the creative process is truly novel, that everything that we generate that's novel is built on past experiences. So the idea being that we kind of borrow and build on is a term that's been used, that fiction writers borrow from their own experiences and twist them a little bit. Comedians, whether they know it or not, just based on the fallibility of memory, are using other people's jokes and twisting them in different ways.
Now, how do you study this connection between memory and creativity and the sort of feedback loop that exists there?
Yeah, so the work that I've been involved with has two different streams, both behavioral experiments and functional magnetic resonance imaging or fMRI work.
Kevin tells participants to recall a specific memory, and he asks lots and lots of details. And then he makes them do a, quote, creative task, like come up with a new use for a hammer, or
come up with creative uses for a newspaper besides reading the paper.
And the people who first recalled a very specific memory later do better with that creative exercise.
And we also see this represented in the brain with fMRIs.
They see more activity in parts of the brain that relate to memory. And generally speaking, there is a lot of overlap between brain regions involved in memory and creativity. It's interesting, you know, because I think sometimes when we think about the creative process, we almost want to shoo away our memory because we want to do something new and exciting, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But it seems like our memory is our great friend in this mm-hmm. process.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems very counterintuitive, but that's certainly what our research has found and what other pieces of evidence in the literature would suggest, that your memory is certainly your friend in most cases in these sorts of situations.
Kevin Medore is a research psychologist at Stanford University. He specializes in human memory. Coming up, does it matter if you remember your dreams?
The salt was really white, and the sky was really blue, and there was sort of like a hazy mirage around the horizon everywhere I looked, and I could feel the sweat on my back, even though it's very cold in the dream.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about memory, where and how memories are stored, what we remember or don't remember. And we wanted to hear from all of you. What helps you remember things?
I have songs from childhood. Like, I still know the 50 states in alphabetical order from fourth grade, from a song that we learned in chorus. Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Connecticut.
I remember I used to make up these stories for biology and chemistry exams where I'd place the different things in different parts of the story that had some relevance to what they actually were. Like nonsensical fictional stories about like Mr. Nucleus, how he stored all the DNA in his closet, I don't know. Something along those lines.
Minnesota, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska.
Like pick a part of the word that I will give a separate meaning that I then associate with the original words. So like for mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. I will take the mite part of mitochondria, turn it into mighty. And then if something's mighty, it's very powerful. So mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
I typically memorize things best through repetition.
New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio.
You know, writing things over and over, that really sticks with you. Even just, you know, with every different curve of the letter, that really helps to memorize things.
Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas.
Thank you for all of those. If you want to be in touch with us, follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at WHYY The Pulse. We're talking about memory. Dreams can be hard to remember, right? Sometimes you wake up and you sort of have this thing that you can just remember, and then it all slips away. But there are people who can remember dreams much better than others. How do they do that? And why do they say this is important to them? Steph Yin has more.
Shady Rose is an artist living in Washington, D.C., and Shady remembers a lot of their dreams in vivid detail.
I woke up in this hole in this salt flat desert with this man looking for me, trying to take me back to the town or the city where I was wanted for something.
As they're talking, Shady gets this far-off look in their eyes.
The salt was really white, and the sky was really blue, and there was sort of like a hazy mirage around the horizon everywhere I looked, and I can feel the sweat on my back, even though it's very cold in the dream.
This is common for Shady. For as long as they can remember, they've had an extremely rich dream world, so much so that they feel like they live two lives, a dream life and a waking life. They've kept a journal since they were young, and they try to record their dreams as often as they can. A lot of their dreams sound like post-apocalyptic movies, like this one recurring dream series, where the world has ended, and Shady's part of a group performing different missions, going to the seed bank, preserving a bunch of books from the Library of Congress.
Did y'all succeed in saving the books?
We did.
Hell yeah.
We did succeed in saving the books.
Congrats.
You know, they're in a vault very deep underground in a ruined Washington, D.C., so... If in the future, you know, we end up in that situation, just know I've got it. I've got it under control.
Some people, like Shady, remember their dreams like they're immersive blockbusters. Others remember just a few fuzzy details, or nothing at all. Why is that? Rafael Vallot, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Berkeley, looked into this question. Using fMRI and PET scans, he compared the brain activity of high dream recallers, people who remember their dreams every day, versus low recallers, who never remember their dreams.
And one thing that we consistently found is that high dream recallers typically have more activity in one specific brain network.
It's called the default mode network. It was only discovered in 2001. The default mode network helps us view and make sense of ourselves. For example, it facilitates episodic memory, or the long-term recollection of specific events and experiences. Your memories of your first day of school, or your first kiss, or a powerful conversation you had with a friend. These are all episodic memories. The default mode network is also active when your mind is wandering, when you're in a dream-like state.
Let's say that you are commuting, you're on the train, you have nothing to do, you're just looking at the landscape on the window and completely lost in your thoughts, then that's when the default mode network is very active.
Raphael's team found the default mode network was more active in high dream recallers, not just when they were asleep, but also when they were awake.
For us, that means that there are some fundamental differences in memory processes between these two groups.
These findings add to a growing body of research that suggests dreams play a role in memory consolidation.
You are actively reprocessing and filtering memories in order to optimize which one you need to remember, which one you can forget. For example, you know, is it relevant for you to remember where you parked your car 2 weeks ago? Probably not.
Scientists know that daydreaming is important in memory consolidation.
And so when you have nothing to do and you're just lost in your thoughts, you will typically reprocess some of the memories, some of the experiences that you experienced maybe the day before, maybe, you know, 1 hour before, or even memories from years ago.
The thought is that's also happening when you're dreaming in sleep, but to an even stronger extent.
Just because the brain state is so different when you are dreaming and you have no like input because you are asleep, we think that this reprocessing of the memories is much, much more efficient when you are actually dreaming than when you are just like, mind wandering. But this is very new, so we don't have all the answers, sadly.
Raphael says this memory reprocessing is likely happening whether or not you recall your dreams upon waking.
Probably you don't need to remember your dreams for them to actually be doing something, you know, for your emotional regulation, memory consolidation, and all that stuff.
Still, lots and lots of people are captivated by their dreams and really want to remember them. What's the use in that? Some believe our dreams tell us something meaningful about our waking lives.
Okay, yeah, so I guess this dream happened in like the last week.
This is Sam. She's doing a dream analysis with Mark Dean, a psychotherapist in Philadelphia. Mark practices Jungian analysis, which is based on the ideas of Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung.
There's a lake. You can see most of it. The sky is pretty big.
In the dream, Sam's in a dangerous situation on a boat with a bunch of people. She helps this one particular woman.
She has like blue acrylic nails with like a lot of diamonds and details on them. And I'm just sort of like comforting her, like, it's okay.
Okay. Could you say a little bit more about the woman with the fingernails? What comes up for you around that?
Yeah. Like there are moments when I want to like have acrylic nails or something like that. And then also many moments where that feels like that doesn't actually fit into my life or who I am. I definitely identified as like a tomboy or something along those lines. But also, yeah, having moments of like deeply wanting that sort of femininity.
Here, the woman with the acrylics maybe represents Sam's relationship with her own femininity. In the dream, she's kind of reconciling with that part of herself. Mark believes this happens a lot in dreams. We think we're interacting with some other person or thing, but we're actually interacting with what he calls shadow aspects of ourselves.
An aspect of the dreamer that the dreamer doesn't fully identify with, and yet somehow or another is lurking in there.
When you talk about dream analysis with researchers, they're reluctant to say anything about it. It's hard to back with evidence. Michael Schradl is a dream researcher at the Central Institute of Mental Health in Mannheim, Germany. He doesn't necessarily believe in Jungian analysis, but he agrees with Mark Dean on this.
Dreams are very clearly related to your waking life experience.
Michael has been recording his dreams for 36 years.
Now I think I have 15,500 dreams, something like that.
Michael thinks dreams often take waking life and exaggerate or dramatize or turn things into metaphor. He says they can give us a window into our inner life.
If, for example, let's say you are avoiding something in your waking life, then you might have a dream of a monster that's chasing you. The main focus is that you have anxiety or panic and you are not confronting anything. You are just running away. Dreams are very helpful to understand what's really important for us.
They're also inspiration for creativity and art. They show us what the mind is capable of.
I think it's still underappreciated that the dream mind is able to produce a whole world without any external input.
Michael says his dreams constantly give him new ways to view the world.
I'm still astonished about the creative function, the creative mode of the dreams.
Shady Rose, from the beginning of our story, incorporates their dreams into their creative work, which involves writing, performance, and visual art. They're the lead singer in a band called Lightmare. This song right here started in a dream.
We describe ourselves as music from that one dream.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.